Fun Ideas Productions presents the Fun Ideas Podcast.
Hi, this is Mark Arnold, and welcome to Fun Ideas Podcast number 215. The Fun Ideas Podcast is brought to you in part by Freaky Magazine. I contribute material to every issue, so give it a try.
Hey kids, have you read Freaky? The magazine of weird humor for freaks like you. Freaky Magazine is a way-out collection of weirdo comics, kooky gags, photo funnies, social satire, and surreal collage. 52 pages of insanity in the tradition of magazines of yore like Cracked, Plop, and Zap. Special offer for Fun Ideas listeners, get a free sample copy in the mail, made of smelly newsprint and smudgy ink the old-fashioned way. Just message your mailing address to theslowpoisoner@gmail.com. That's theslowpoisoner@gmail.com while supplies last.
Until now is Mark Arnold's latest book called Pac-Man, the first animated show based upon a video game. This book tells the story of Pac-Man phenomenon and goes through the entire history of the Hanna-Barbera Animation Studios. The history of the video games, pre-Pac-Man, the history of Pac-Man, the character, the video game, the spin-offs, the merchandise, and the animated TV series. Each and every episode of the classic 1980 series is covered and examined. Plus, Mark Arnold covers how Pac-Man has been honored on various anniversaries, including the 40th anniversary in 2021. A fun read for casual and hardcore Pac-Man and video game fans alike, featuring mini character model sheets and other images. Available online through Bear Manor Media, Amazon, and Barnes & Noble. Get your copy today.
Friends, have you tried Lee's Comics? Lee's Comics is better than the leading comic book store. Wait a minute. Lee's Comics is the leading comic book store. Based on arbitrary standards set by Lee Hester himself.
Lee's Comics was named as one of the 21 best online dealers by PopOptique.com. To shop the Lee's Comics eBay store, go to eBay and search for Lee's Comics, Inc. That's LEESCOMICSINC, period. Don't forget the period. Mention the Fun Ideas Podcast when you order, and you'll receive a free bonus gift. The revised second edition of my Monkeys book with Michael A. Ventrella, called Long Title, the stars of Walt Disney Productions, and the Pac-Man, the first animated TV show based upon a video game, are my latest books out now. I just turned in my manuscript for Unconditionally Mad, and the Turtles book is in production. I'm also working on my TV Cartoons of Time Forgot book, plus articles on Nightmare the Galloping Ghost and Harvey Superheroes. On today's show, we have a guest who has had an extensive career in the comic book industry, including writing for Comic Buyer's Guide and her work for Eclipse and Claypool Comics. Here she is, Kat Ironwood.
Hi, this is Mark Arnold, and welcome to another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast. And on today's episode, we have Catherine Ironwood, and I just want to welcome you to the show today. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You came as a request from my friend Lee Hester. I don't know if you know who he is.
Oh, of course I know Lee Hester.
Yeah.
Shout out to Lee. Hi,
yeah.
Lee.
He's been saying, you need to get Kat Ironwood on the show. You need to get, and I go, okay. I mean, I know of you, and I think I've probably emailed and texted you before for various questions for articles I've written in back issue and stuff like that. But I don't know if we've actually ever spoke till now. So welcome. So I guess how I usually start off is kind of tell me a little bit about yourself and I guess, did you want to get into comics, or how did you get into what you ultimately are known for? I'll say that.
Well, I grew up in a family of academics and librarians, publishers, and authors, and bankers too, although I was not part of that. And I was raised by my mother, who was a research librarian at the University of California, and then at UCLA. And I liked comics because I liked art, and I bought a Disney's Donald Duck Vacation Parade, and I really liked it. And I was reading it at the library at UCLA. My mother worked there on Saturdays, but she didn't want to pay for a babysitter, and I was well behaved, so she brought me along, and it was okay with her boss, whose name was Wilbur Smith, and his boss, whose name was Lawrence Clark Powell, after whom the Powell Library was named. And I was reading this comic book, and my mother was embarrassed. She was an immigrant. She was a refugee from Germany, and her English was rather poor, and she spoke many languages. And she was embarrassed, and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, my daughter's reading a comic book." And Wilbur said, "Oh no, comic books are popular culture." And then he, because he felt that now I was embarrassed, he turned to me and he said, "You know, you have to keep that very well. Don't break the spine. And when you're done with it, you want to put it in some place to exclude light and keep it dry." And I said, "Like what?" And he goes, "Like this." And he brought me a manila envelope. And he said, "When you're done with this, put it in here, close it, don't lick it, just put it away and lay it flat." And he goes, you'll want that later when you're an adult." And I went, "Okay." So then I had some Mad magazine. Actually, these were Mad Comics.
Oh, yeah.
And I read them, and I did the same thing. And after a while, Wilbur took an interest in this. And he said, "Oh, you have quite a collection of these, and you're keeping them all very well for posterity. Some library may want those at a later time." So I began to collect comics very conscientiously. And around that time, I first noticed that people signed comics. I didn't know that they had. I saw a comic book. It was a Mad, and it had a log on it. And in the log was carved the letters Wood. And I was sick with the Asiatic flu. And my mother said, "What can I get you? You have to stay home from school. What can I get you?" And I said, "Bring me more comic books with Wood in them." And she said, "What do you mean, Wood?" And I said, "Here, this." And she goes, "Oh, that must be his signature. That must be an artist named Wood." And she turned to the front, and of course it said Wallace Wood. And she said, "So I'll go and find you some more comics with art by Wallace Wood." And she found me a bunch of them. Right? And so that was my first introduction that they were named people, that you could find out who they were. And I really became interested then in basically buying everything that Wally Wood had ever done.
Wow.
When I finally met him, I was almost in tears, you know, my childhood hero. And he was so sweet and almost in tears. He said, "I can't believe that you started following me at such a young age and really like my stuff," because I'd always written about how important he was to me. And so we had a wonderful meeting eventually. So part of it was I just was interested in comics. And then later, I was interested in boys. And I noticed that more boys read comics than girls. And so there were also more boys rode bicycles than girls. But I have very poor vision, and I couldn't ride bicycles. But more boys repaired automobiles. So I became interested in vintage car customization and comic books, because those were two places where I could hang out and be around boys and smell how good they smelled. And, and you know, they just were very attractive to me. It would be the equivalent of a boy deciding to take up embroidery, perhaps, just so he could be around girls. And so eventually I had a huge collection of comics, and I then, you know, sort of drifted away from that. I went in living into, I was very left-wing politically, went to live in a commune and got into gardening. I was much into gardening and animal husbandry. But, and I got married and various things happened, and I mean, just a long story. Mm-hmm. And that marriage broke up, and I was sitting there crying, and I thought, what did I do before I was married? And I thought, oh, comics. And of course, I had the whole box of these comics in these manila envelopes from before plastic, you know, they were all in their little manila envelopes. And I thought, I'm going to read comics again, because it's something I did. And I found a boyfriend, and this will lead me back to boyfriendhood. So I had a friend, and I was telling him my plan. And he said, oh, so much has changed since you were last in comics. I was a letter hack, and I would attend conventions and things like that, science fiction conventions that had comics as an outlier. And I stumbled upon, he showed me a more recent issue of Doctor Strange. And I thought, I'm going to write them again, just write a letter again. And I wrote, and it was printed. And weirdly, comic boys being comic boys, I got 3 proposals of marriage.
Wow.
And I thought, well, this is going to work, but not those guys, but this is going to work. I'll keep on letter hacking. And I, of course, I'm a writer. I was writing about vintage farm machinery. I'm a writer, and I like to write nonfiction. And I was writing about how to repair your Singer sewing machine or whatever it might be. And I began writing more and more for comics, letter hacking. And eventually that led me to taking off and going to a Phil Suling con. He paid me for me to write one of his program books. I had to interview everybody who was going to be there at the program. And I then, got to show up. And that just led to a career in comics fandom. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I met Dean Mullaney, who with his brother had started Eclipse Comics. And they wanted me as a colorist and editor and typesetter. And I was already, by that time, I was already working for a man named Ken Pierce, who's still around, by the way. You should talk to him someday. Okay. Ken Pierce was publishing newspaper strip reprints. And I was working on those with a guy named Dennis McFarling. And he was doing the paste-ups, you know, hot wax paste-ups. And I was writing the intros for Ken Pierce. And it just led to an offer from Alan Light of the Buyer's Guide to write a column for the Buyer's Guide, because I had my own typesetting machine and I could produce typeset copy. And so that turned into something called Fit to Print, which was a joke, because the idea was to make it fit the space exactly, right?
Right.
And do my own paste up and everything. And then Dean Mullaney offered me a job at Eclipse, and I kept on working for Ken Pierce. And then I had wanted to interview Will Eisner. I really admired him. And I got Gary Groth at the Comics Journal to okay that he would actually print an interview with Will Eisner if I did it. Mm-hmm. And so I went there and I interviewed Will. And Will and I hit it off, and his wife, Ann, and I became great friends. And at some point, he wanted me to come and catalog his material. So I cataloged all of his art. And then I became his agent for selling his art, and also became in charge of numbering the pieces, the stories. There was no catalog. I created a catalog for them. And then I was hired by Dennis Kitchen of Kitchen Sink to oversee the reprinting of Spirit Stories. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of, you know, one thing led to another. And then Eclipse got bigger and bigger, and I was the editor there. Then that's what I did. And when Dean and I divorced, he fired me from Eclipse, essentially. But I was still working for Claypool, because Eclipse had been distributing Claypool.
I see.
And when Claypool went to online only, oh, and then I married, I've got to explain, then I married somebody else named Nagashiba Ironwood. And I worked for Claypool. And when Claypool went to online only, we were let go. But in the meantime, I'd started my own publishing company and metaphysical store, Lucky Mojo Curio Company and Lucky Mojo Books. So there you go. And along the way, I got one other thing. In between, I also was a staff editor for Organic Gardening Magazine during the period that after Eclipse went under and before Lucky Mojo got off the ground, because the then editor of Organic Gardening was a big fan of Marvel Comics and a friend of Stan Lee's, and he'd liked my fan writing, and he hired me to be a staff editor at Organic Gardening. And now I write in the area of folk magic and the popular culture and material culture of fortune telling. Hmm. I've been doing that for about 25 years.
Wow. So I have so many questions based on all that.
Okay. Now, well, that was it. Now you got the whole resume.
Yeah, I got the story, but you know, I have questions based on what you said. So, I guess the number one question I would have, and I'm going to jump around because you just said everything so nicely and chronologically, and I'm just going to ruin that. okay. A lot of people, well, I don't know about a lot of people. So I'll say some people, think you just kind of gave up on comics and just turned your back on it. Are you still a fan of comic books today, or
yes I am, but also you have to remember another thing that I did. You don't have to remember it, I have to remember to mention it, which was trading cards. Eclipse got into trading cards, and I've been a trading card collector, sport, but mostly non-sport, all my life, cigarette cards and stuff like that. And I'm a typesetter, and I got into typesetting, neat typesetting. And so typesetting has always been, and book editing is, and book production has always been a part of my life as well as comics. Mm. So for instance, when I worked for Claypool, I was typesetting their letter calls. And so for me, those two skills go hand in hand. Coloring, I was a very good colorist in comics, not particularly good letterer, although I'm actually an adequate letterer. Mm. I'm not a good drawer. And I don't like, and this is the big confession here, I don't like writing fiction. I like editing fiction. I like reading fiction, mm-hmm. but I don't like writing it, because once I create a character, I don't want to create a problem for them that might damage or hurt them. I'm too sentimental about characters. If I wrote comics, everyone would be in the pretty green meadows with the pretty flowers, and little Bambi deers would come to say hi, and the squirrels. It would be like, you know, the scene where Snow White wakes up and it's all pretty around her and all the little animals. I would write that endlessly. That's no my story, right? I had a friend named Roger Slifer who wrote My Little Pony. And he said, yeah, but you could write My Little Pony. And I said, I bet I could too, except for you'd have to write the part where they had a problem. So I became very good at editing other people's writing. Yeah. And I'm also a very good reviewer. In other words, if someone brings me a story, I can suggest rearrangements and things like that. But I'm not a fiction writer. So with the idea of doing color, and I love fancy show card lettering. I can just go off about lettering and typesetting. And I really got into labels. I collect label art, graphic label art of the late 19th and early 20th century, up to about World War II. Mm-hmm. Mostly chromolithographic from up to World War I. And so all of that stuff is what drew me to comics, because I loved the coloring system. You know, the what used to be called the YRB system, mm-hmm. and which is a simplified version of the CMYK color system. Anyway, all that stuff was what drew me to comics, in addition to, you know, Superman saves the town. I mean, you know, that I liked also.
Right.
But there was something else going on in comics that I didn't like, which became more and more of a reliance on weapons in among the superheroes. And I really, I may be simplifying by referring to Punisher, but when the Punisher came out, I really felt there was no place for me in editing that kind of material. Mm-hmm. And we were doing Airboy, and a guy named Chuck Dixon was a very good writer and was writing Airboy, but it became more and more about the guns and the violence. And he was throwing out very highly charged political, you know, Soviets and communists and Nazis. And I'm like, this is not exactly, he would kind of equate communists and Nazis. It was just, you know, eternal villain with bigger and bigger guns. And I really began to feel that, like at the end of Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai, when the guy brings the gun, the samurai have all these fabulous fighting skills, and they have camaraderie, and they have courage, and they protect the peasants. And suddenly a gun is introduced, mm-hmm. and this whole way of life comes tumbling down. And that's, I felt, happened with comics. and it was sometimes referred to as the new, grittier, more realistic comics. Yeah. And I realized I was not interested in comics about rape and do you know what I'm saying? It was like it became a social environment that attracted fans who wanted to see more and more violence, and attracted also writers and artists who wanted to draw more violence. Also, one other factor, do you know who Frank Zane is? Okay.
Not sure.
Old school bodybuilder. He's still alive. Frank Zane was a bodybuilder who was very pre-steroids, and he was a, you know, just a weightlifter type guy, very pretty, very well-formed body. I thought found him very attractive. He modeled, or inadvertently modeled, his pictures were used by people to draw Tarzan. So he had the kind of Tarzan-ish body.
Got it.
And I thought he was the height of female, excuse me, of male muscular achievement. When Arnold Schwarzenegger came along and steroids became more and more of a thing, the male bodies that were, I have to explain here, I follow weightlifting, I follow wrestling, I follow those kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. And they became less and less human looking to me. Now, I ought to explain at this point, if you haven't figured out already, I am autistic. I'm a high functioning autistic person. So for me, looking at people and seeing that it's a human and not just a figure against a background is sometimes a little difficult. And figuring out what people's emotions or faces are, that's why I really like comics, because the emotions were so clearly drawn on their faces. And what I began to see were things that didn't please me. And these big, bulgy men, and I don't mean John Buscema bulgy. I don't mean, you know, Buscema Conan. I mean, that's bulgy. That was getting to the Arnold Schwarzenegger era. That's okay. But it became worse and worse and worse. And it soon began not to look like human figures anymore.
Right, right. I know
and
exactly.
I'm not going to name any names, but the first name Rob may ring a bell with you. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to name anybody and put anybody down, but there was a moment where I looked at that and I thought, is this a leg or is it a shape? You know what I mean?
Right.
And I liked Kirby well, but I liked Ditko more. If you're going to put me back in that era, you know, because Ditko drew, well, he drew himself and he drew that very slim baseball pitcher, swimmer physique. I liked that. Those kinds of characters no longer even featured in best-selling comics.
Right.
So, no, I didn't turn my back on comics. Comics just simply stopped producing things that I wanted to pay my money for.
Yeah.
And when I no longer had a job, you know, then I had to pay all my own money. So I used to get review copies and I edited them. I could hire artists. I could say, hey, let's do this. I like people like Paul Galassi. You know, I like people who drew Strenko. I like people who drew that kind of human body. Right. And the stories had a human dimension. I like Will Eisner because he drew very human and humane stories. I don't watch the comic book movies anymore, the so-called franchise movies, because they're very grim. Yeah. And I find them depressing. And I'm not saying that in my ideal world, heroes must always triumph at the end of the story. I'm not saying that. It's not that I'm a Pollyanna and want a children's book. I have read a lot of stories of loss, but I have gotten meaning out of them. But, you know, give me a Bill Sienkiewicz, someone who can actually draw anatomy, you know?
Right.
And so when that was devalued, a lot of my friends, especially in the left-leaning friends, went into undergrounds. But underground comics took another turn toward what I would call sexual misogyny and rape and you know, weird things like that that did not feel comfortable to me as a woman. Mm-hmm. Women's comics were okay, but they were always, you know, holding up the banner for feminism. And I wasn't sure that wasn't what I wanted out of comics. I wanted cool stories. So, no, I didn't turn my back on comics, and I still do read comics. But I tend to read more That's kind of more introspective comics. I think one of the best comics I ever worked on was Zot by Scott McCloud, which was an attempt to really show inner meaning as well as a beautiful art style. And I don't have any one art style. I mean, I've ranged all the way here from Sid Kevich to Scott McCloud. You know, that's pretty quite a big difference right there. But I appreciate art for what it is. Mm-hmm. But I feel that this is symptomatic of something much worse in society.
Yeah.
And you don't want me to go all political on you, but right now, everything, I was considered a freak or a weirdo in comics because I would talk about things like politics and the environment and, mm-hmm. you know, voters' rights and things like that. And, you know, people would say to me, shut up about that. We're into superheroes, right?
Right.
So I find now that our entire country has become very uncomfortable for well-meaning, compassionate people to live in.
Mm-hmm.
I've just become an old, old raging leftist Jewish grandmother, you know?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I don't read as many comics as I used to. I mean, here's what I read now, and they're all reprints. One is the current issues of Mad. It's 99% reprint. And Looney Tunes, which is like 50 to 75% reprint.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And
see, years ago, I'd have stacks, even in the 90s and the aughts, you know, I would have stacks of comics. But, you know, when everything became so superhero focused, I always like to say, oh, I don't like superhero comics. Well, that's not really true. I just don't like the way, like what you're saying is what they developed into. You know, yeah. I can read, like today, even I was reading Ditko's Spider-Man because they're putting out those little Marvel Masterworks book reprints. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those early issues I've never read before because they weren't in an affordable version. So mm-hmm. I'm reading them now, you know, and enjoying them. And I said, why can't they just do comics like this now? But I said, well, at least they're reprinting them. So I'm reading these now. So
right. Well, that's the thing. I read those all fresh off the stands.
Yeah.
And they were very, Ditko Spider-Man was very meaningful to me. So was Doctor Strange, mm-hmm. because it went along with my interest in metaphysics and the occult, which was a whole nother parallel thing that I was interested in. And, I guess I have to say, I'm not trying to rag on comics. They became what they became, sales drive, content.
Mm-hmm.
And I found other things. I mean, I'm just as fascinated with vintage handkerchief print patterns. I know that sounds crazy. Fabric printing. I mean, I have many, many interests.
Yeah.
Comics really attracted me because of the coloring system, the limited color system.
Mm-hmm.
And I was responsible, I guess I should say, partially responsible, but I'll take full credit, for really popularizing another layer of color. In other words, instead of just YRB, coming up with Y4R4B4. I know this sounds crazy, but you know that my little color charts meant something to people, and I really got into it because I was very concerned that Black people, which were a tritone color, were always either the same color of brown, or if the ink lay on the press was wrong, they would come out with green skin. And it would, because the yellow would be up too gained. And so I look at that sort of thing. So I thought, well, if we do this this 70% color, which meant just more cutting of, we were really into it, but and printing on white paper, I wanted to make sure that various skin tones were accurately portrayed. And I also was very interested in sunsets and color scales, like in The Old Terry and the Pirates by Milton Caniff, which mm-hmm. were airbrushed. And when computer coloring came in, I embraced it 100%. Mm-hmm. And I still am completely agog at the beauty of computer coloring. They're able to do the most amazing effects. The problem is the underlying art often is just these bulging sausages of matter, protoplasm. They don't look like people.
Right, right.
So, but when you go back to the beauty of Disney coloring, for instance, I'm a fan of old animation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really have to say what you're talking about is the kind of stuff that I still enjoy. And not because it's childish and safe, but because it's clever and right. funny and mm-hmm. it's pretty.
Yep.
It's, prettiness is a big factor in comics, and one person's prettiness is not the same as another's. And maybe if I think something is pretty, you're going to think, oh, well, she's just, you know, very narrow-minded. She has limited taste. So it is. I like acoustic blues music, mm-hmm. and I like acoustic string band music, mm-hmm. and I'm not a big fan of heavy metal. So what? Mm-hmm. You know? I don't sit around and weep and piss and moan because Charlie Poole and the North Carolina Ramblers, who are dead, don't have a number one hit. I just go and listen to them anytime I want right. to. Yeah. And that's the thing you mentioned, reprints.
Yeah,
that's one of the wonders of the digital age, is that we can have everything we ever wanted now.
Yeah,
that's good.
And we have the computer where we can order it off in a second. You know, right. we don't that's have to right. search for it. You know, some that's people right. miss the thrill of the hunt. I do to a certain extent, but at the same time, it's like, it's nice to just say, oh, I want to get this book. Oh, there it is. Order done.
Yeah. I have found out that there's a place called Pick Click. Have you ever been to Pick Click?
Yeah. Yeah.
I still get the thrill of the hunt from Pick Click, whereas I don't from eBay, because it's just sort of yes or no at eBay. But at Pick Click, it just gives you thousands of variations on yeah. your query, because yep. it has a very wide query that it does on your behalf. Mm-hmm. But see, I also, again, I'm atypical. I collect restaurant ware with logos on it, you know, script logos, you know, restaurant ware from the teens, 20s. I have more cupboards of restaurant ware than I probably should admit to having. And I just for the script and the colors. So I get my dopamine hits from a variety of visual yeah. input.
Well, I'm with you. I don't just, you know, I don't know if you know anything about me, but I'm a writer as well. I've written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but,
I do.
But I go all over the map. I do animation, music, TV, movies. And, you know, as far as my collecting tastes, I have things like I like old theme park travel brochures and maps oh, yeah. and things like that. I have a whole file of that. Nobody knows that because I don't talk about it.
But, that's wonderful.
You know, but I, you know, I'm with you as far as, you know, I keep it because of how it looks. I like how certain packaging looks. I have books about cereal boxes and books about toys, yeah. you know, because it yeah. shows like how they used to market and package these things to attract the eye and stuff like that. And a lot of these things they don't do anymore for whatever yeah. reason, you know, if it's considered old hat, I don't know, but it's like, it really attracts me because I go, hey, you could still do it that way. It's just,
yeah.
they don't.
Well, you know? I put out a line of books on folk magic, and mm-hmm. our covers are very much vintage retro, including art, public domain art that we pick up from the past. Mm-hmm. And we color them with, you know, very clean comic book colors. Mm-hmm. And I also design labels for these 200 and some products that we make in our shop. And I've hired comic book artists to work on our labels and on our covers as well. And that's kind of a trip. But I collect old catalogs just for the catalog art. I just yep. love it, you know. And so I found that I could separate my love of art from my love of narrative. And that's sort of interesting, because as a child, they were bound up together in comic books.
Right.
And I would read stories with no illustrations. I read Nancy Drew, for instance. That yeah. was all narrative. If you were lucky, you got the dust wrapper, you got one picture, right?
Yeah, right. That was it.
Plus the inside silhouette on the inside cover. And so I can follow narrative and enjoy narrative a great deal, but I really love art. And yeah. I collected a lot of illustrated children's books around the same time as I began to seriously collect comics. So mm-hmm. those go back to the teens and 20s, a lot of Chromo Litho.
Yeah. I'm actually collecting more of those now, old children's books, because I don't buy new comics anymore. So, yeah. You know, there's certain artists, you know, children's books wise, I'll just name a couple, you know, Dr. Seuss or Richard Scarry or
Richard Scarry.
Going back for Jean de Brunhoff, you know, the Babar books and things like that. And Lawrence, you know, his son. And, you know, it's like, you know, I used to read them all as a kid, but I never owned them because, oh, they're in the library. I can always check them out or whatever. They're always, you know, now it's like they're sometimes harder to find, but also I just want to own them so I can like pour over the pictures. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I learned about collecting. My mother, as I mentioned, was a librarian, but she was also a rare book dealer. Mm-hmm. And she made it very clear to me, if they belong to a library, you can have access to them, but you have no control. They may be deacquisitioned by the library, right, and be sold for 50 cents a pound. Right. You don't know what's going to happen. So if you want to build a collection, build your own, with an idea toward contributing it somewhere. So when I was working for Eclipse, everything we did, including all of our internal office memos, correspondence, all of the production layers of, you know, like photocopies of pencils, the lettering, overlays, everything was sent to Michigan State University Library. Every month we would put together a big box for them. Mm-hmm. And they have the entire Eclipse stuff there for researchers. Mm-hmm. So I felt really good about putting that in a library. And I've always had that sort of connection with Michigan State and also with Ohio State University Library. Meanwhile, I'm collecting right now. I've gone off into this thing of collecting pamphlets about fortune telling that date back from the 1890s onward. And these, and I, my arbitrary cutoff date is always World War II or something about that, because the printing changes to litho offset, and so it's interesting printing. But I have a huge pile, a bookshelf after bookshelf, you know, how to read palms, how to read tea leaves. And I put out bibliographies of them, but I'm hoping to interest some library. I know of no library that has a collection of antique pamphlets on fortune telling. Hmm. And yet it's a part of our popular culture.
Yeah. You know?
It's interesting. And I think it's, for me, has always also been about reproducibility and popular culture. My mother, you know, took me around to all the great, you know, museums and cathedrals of Europe, and we would look at the Tiepolo, or we would look at the Mantegna, or whatever it is we're looking at, and but there's only one copy. Hmm. And the art books of that time period, the 1950s, the copies were not well reproduced, and in some cases the pictures themselves that they were photographing had been marred by grime and smoke over the years, and they hadn't been cleaned. And so I would look at the real thing and I'd say, well, no, this is better. So then I began to think about collecting mass produced art. And I think Maxfield Parrish was one of my first thing, you know, ventures into Maxfield Parrish made these pieces of art, and they were by the hundred. And there's a guy named Harry Roseland who did paintings of fortune tellers. And African-American fortune tellers, no less. And at a time when that was like 1901 and 1906, that was a very odd thing for him to be painting. It was a genre painter. But these were then reproduced on calendars and postcards. And of course, the oil paintings still exist. But they were made for reproduction. And so the idea of mass-produced art, like at the restaurant where with the beautiful lettering, or the trading cards, cigarette cards and so forth, with the beautiful paintings of flowers, there's something about the mass production. And then of course the obsessive, and I know you'll know what I'm talking about, the obsessive upgrading.
Yes.
Right. So I just said the word obsessive upgrading. And I have a patron account, Patreon account, and I offer my patrons, if they paid a certain rate, a flat rate UPS postal service box filled with my cast-offs once I've upgraded. So they just sign on to get, they get postcards, they get books, they get whatever they're going to get. It's just the kickdown, because I can't be bothered going to eBay and selling this stuff. It's pointless, you know?
Right.
But I am constantly upgrading and trying to have, you know, near mint, you know, the insane quest for near mint postcards of tea rooms in New Hampshire. You know? that somebody once asked me, what do you collect? And I answered, what don't I collect?
I could almost say that, but I try to keep things in, a limited scope as best I can, but it's difficult sometimes, so I always say,
well, I'm looking at you and you're here. I'm looking at what looks to be sort of a wooden craftsman style case. Oh, and those might be
back there. Okay,
yeah, back behind you.
It's that has my books in the case. It has some actually those are Monkees solo albums, believe it or not. Above my shoulder. And then what else is back there? Oh, just photographs underneath the CD case way back there. I still love CDs. I love DVDs.
Do you know those life-size mummy cases they were selling for a while? Life-size Repro mummy cases. They're 8 feet tall. Yep. You open them up and they hold DVDs. Mm-hmm. My husband and I have two mummy cases, one female and one male, completely filled with vintage pre-code and early post-code Poverty Row DVDs.
Wow.
Because... why? I don't know. Because I'm a train fanatic, and a lot of times for cheap location shooting, they'd shoot in a train yard. And I'm going, oh my God, there goes the daylight, or oh, it's the UP, And you could tell where they were filming. And so a lot of these films have rather low production values. But, oh, look, here comes Clayton Moore, but he's pre-Lone Ranger, and he's punching somebody in the face, And there's always a reason to watch these old serials and old movies, but a lot of it is for location shots, especially of Southern California, where I lived briefly for 3 years when I was a kid. Location shots of Los Angeles. I'm just a fanatic about that. Architecture, retro and old architecture.
So my next question is, so when you got into comics where you were actually publishing them, and I assume, was Eclipse the first you worked at, or was it Kitchen Sink?
Ken Pierce.
Okay, but I guess it applies to every place. How did you come across the people that you eventually published? Were you meeting them at the like the Phil Suling show, or people sent in submissions, or how did that work?
Ken Pierce did reprints. So he was reprinting newspaper strips. But I happened to have had fandom connections with some of those people who were still alive. Mm-hmm. And Ken made a very fundamental error. I'll never let him forget it. I'm going to laugh. He couldn't tell the difference between Klaus Nordling's art and Nick Carty's art, for which he should be slapped with a wet
knife.
And he put the wrong credits on him. Yeah, I know. I was like, what? I sent him an enraged letter. And as he told me later, he saw this, he goes, I got to get this woman off my back. I better hire her. And so he hired me. And that got me involved in outreach to older strip artists and trying to, getting permissions and stuff. He worked with the syndicates and stuff like that end of it. And I worked with the artists, and including getting them to write their memoir for a little introduction. So I started with that. And then when I was working for Alan Light, I began getting reviews, copies of DC and Marvel books, and doing interviews with people. And then I was doing interviews for the Comics Reader and for Comics Journal. Okay. And also for another fanzine called The Heroine Showcase, which was only about female characters. And I would write historical articles and stuff. But I also, in order to do that, I'd call up and interview people and say, like Alex Toth or whatever, and say, tell me what you did in that or the other. And so I became friends with some of those people. And I realized, they were freelancers, most of them, and they, always needed a job. When I got together with Kitchen Sink, he was publishing Underground Comics, which as I said, they had a sort of a misogynistic outlook that I didn't find humorous. But I was involved only with The Spirit, which was he was publishing. And so I organized a Spirit story, in which was done as a round robin, in which everyone did a page or two. All my friends that I knew.
Okay, I remember that.
What?
Spirit, was that called Spirit Jam? Is that what that was?
Spirit Jam. That's
okay,
right.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, and I had the pleasure of being drawn by Brent Anderson, who drew me very prettily. And so I was, you know, when I did that Suling Khan program book, that was, you know, sort of helped people to get to know me. So when I got together with Eclipse, I basically brought, he had his friends in comics. He lived in New York. I mean, and I just sort of brought my friends along, and some of our friends were both of our friends. I mean, he was already publishing people that I knew when I joined his company with him and Jan. So it became sort of a thing of bringing in those people. But then there was another thing that I did, which I really liked doing, which was we would get all of these requests from people. They would send in samples of their art. Can you hire me? And they usually did display poses. And many of them were good display poses, but there was no narrative. So I wrote a sample 5-page story, which was so generic that you could pretty much do anything you wanted with it. And that story I then carried around to the different conventions, to Dallas and Houston and Tulsa, Oklahoma and New York. And I'd hand out this this assignment to them. If they showed me their art, I'd say, well, you know, I critique it. This is nice. You handle the musculature nice. And often they were children, and I would, their parents would be there, and I'd say, you know, Timmy is doing pretty well, but he's drawing with ballpoint pens on letter paper. Do you know that comics are produced on Bristol board? And I'd hold it up. I said, this is Bristol board. Would you like a sheet of it? And the, you know, if they should draw a pencil first and then a pen. Here, let me give you a list of art supplies. And then Timmy is pretty good and might want to get special art classes or maybe go to art school. But in any case, and then I would turn to Timmy, I said, but whatever your mother can provide for you, that's fine. But I'd like you to get your best friend who also likes to draw. And I want you each to get just leotard and tights, like you would have if you were a male ballet dancer. And I want you to have a nice light source. And I want you to draw each other. Just sit and draw each other over and over. Draw from life. Don't just think that comic book artists have to memorize the insertion of the muscles. Of course, they memorize it, but they also have to look at life. And then these next year, I'd come back, and by then I'd say, here's a 5-page script. Now try to do a script. And this script had everything in it, from pirate ships to dogs, little old ladies, cops. It had everything. It had a 2-point perspective, 3-point perspective, where this person had to jump and fly. And all this stuff was in this one story. And it, and I'd say, now you draw this story and come back in a year when I'll be coming through this convention again. And I would hold court. And one other person really got good at this with me, who really enjoyed what I was doing, and that was Joe Kubert. And Kubert and I talked about it. And then Mark Evanier kind of joined in, and he'd say, yeah. He'd say, go see Cash. I'll tell you what you need to do. Yeah. But he would be really good at critiquing their stories. So we formed whole panels where we would just sit there and bring in these young kids. And there's a point to this story, which is eventually they'd come back and you'd go, oh my God, you've grown up. You now are not 12 years old. You're now 19. This is totally professional work. You're ready for a backup at Marvel or DC. And then I would literally take their stuff and say, you know, go find Dick Giordano or somebody, say, look at this person. Or I'd say, let me hire this person. We'll do, have you do a backup, because the next part of it isn't whether they can draw and do a narrative and leave spaces open for color and all the things that you need in comics. The next thing is, can they meet a deadline? And if they can't meet a deadline, they'll never have a career.
Right.
And so this gave rise to what I call Julie Schwartz's law. Julie Schwartz said this to me one day. He never meant it as a law, but I publicized it that way. And he always said, did I say that? And what he said was, to work in comics, you can be three things. You can be really, really good at what you do. You can be always on time. And you can be a hell of a nice guy. And you only have to be two of the three to get steady work in comics for the rest of your life. Okay.
I've heard that before, but I didn't know it was Julie who said it.
Yeah, Julie said that, and I wrote it down, published it, and I called it Julie's Law. Next year, he came up to me at San Diego. He goes, what the hell is Julie's Law? Everybody's telling me that it's the smartest thing they've ever seen. So I now, when I interview people for any kind of thing that I'm doing with them, I have three radio buttons in my database, G, N, T. Good, nice, timely. And so that's Julie Saw. So I then began to cultivate these younger artists, but I knew that Eclipse didn't pay as much as DC or Marvel, and they were really wanting to draw Spider-Man. I would always ask them, what do you want to draw? You know, and they would say, oh, I want to draw Batman or whatever. And you would then give them a story that brought out their Batman-like strengths, you know, some architecture, some night scenes. And if they said, I really always, you know, wanted to, you know, draw Looney Tunes, you'd say, well, we'll do a little comedic backup, you know, whatever it would be. And then I would say, now you have something you can show.
Yeah.
And they would then go on and get, and only one person ever screwed the fuck out of us, and I'm not going to name him. We signed him up for a 6-part miniseries, and he did 3 parts, and he said, I've been hired from DC, and I don't have time for you anymore.
Wow.
And I thought, should I find someone else to fill his shoes or just let it die? And I was angry enough. I let the series die and I let everyone know why. Because that wasn't faithful and loyal of him. You know, he should have done, he could have slowed the pace down and said, listen, I'm working part-time for DC. And when I get the 6 done, well, I'll go full-time with DC. But no, he just dumped us. And he's not in comics anymore either because he's not a hell of a nice guy.
Yeah.
And he's not timely. He's only very, very, very good at what he does.
Yeah. Interesting.
So yeah, so you know, when you have very little money to play with, you have to make what you can, put yourself, don't fight the hierarchy. You know, we were never a big company, but we were always somebody who brought people along. As a publisher now in the occult metaphysical field, I do the same thing. I do a series, I do 96-page books. It's a format I kind of got into with Ken Pierce, long story. He was doing 48-page books because 48 pages is the smallest you can put a spine on. Mm-hmm. And most bookstores want a spine, but 96 is the smallest spine you can read the lettering on. So 96-page books on metaphysics and occult. And those people, who some people stay with me, but most of them will parlay either 1 or 2 books into a contract with a much bigger publisher. And in the case of metaphysics, it's a company called Llewellyn. Or sometimes Wiser, Red Wheel. They go to them. They never come back to me, but I've started them and I feel good about it. Mm-hmm. And the only thing is my contract with them is perpetual unless I let it go out of print.
Right.
And I keep the books in print and I still pay them a royalty every time I reprint, and the royalty says 100% as if it was brand new each time we reprint. So I'm a fair dealer, but I know my role. So how do I bring those people in? I just look at their organizational skills, their timeliness to deadlines, and if they're nice. If they're not nice, why work with them?
You know? Right.
So there you go. There's Julie's Law.
Cool. Now in Eclipse, a lot of the early things you brought in were from Pacific Comics. Did Eclipse buy them out, or did you just approach all the different people that were like
Sergio? It was an agent. That's a very good question, and not enough people have asked that over the years. Have you ever heard of a man named Mike Friedrich?
Yes.
He did what was called Ground Level Comic. It wasn't an underground, but it wasn't a mainstream, and it was called Star Reach.
Yeah.
And Star Reach eventually stopped publishing, but he became a comic book agent. And he was an agent for artists, and he was an agent for brokering deals in the comics field. And he was a person I knew well. He was in the Bay Area, and so was I. And when Pacific Comics went out of business, he basically brokered what he could to DC and Marvel, but there wasn't much, and so they were not that interested, because they had their own character rosters. But we had all these variety comics, and we had the ability to do miniseries. So he came to us with books in various states of completion. So some of them were literally camera ready. Some of them were like ready to go on press, but the printer hadn't been paid the advance, right? Other ones were just penciled or just penciled and inked, or they were just a script. And so he brought us all of this, Mike Friedrich, and he was our broker, and we did a very good deal with him. I mean, the Shaynus brothers were pleased because the artists got their stuff printed. We got some very good things. Some of those people stayed with us for a while, like, they became to like us, but other ones went immediately on and considered it as a done contract and went on to another publisher because they're freelancers. You know, freelancers know where the money is.
Yeah.
But that's how we got those characters. Yeah. Okay. Then we found out later that there was another broker, a British broker named Des Skin.
Oh, yeah.
And Des Skin had brokered the English stuff from Warrior to Mike Friedrich without telling Mike Friedrich that he actually didn't own the rights to Miracle Man or Marvel Man, as it was called. He actually was lying, and he was also trying to agent art, which he claimed that he had the rights to agent because he had color negatives and color prints of these things that for reproduction that seemed to show that he was able to broker them, but he didn't. He was lying, and many people turned out never gotten paid, and Eclipse got a bad name because they said, well, Eclipse ripped me off, I never got my paycheck, but we had paid Des Skin. Friedrich brokered that deal between us and Des Skin, and Friedrich's reputation suffered as a result, as did Eclipse's, because Des Skin was a criminal. But there you go. That's, you know, that happens, you know.
Yeah.
It was like there was something wrong with Des Skin's mind. I'm just going to say that. He would do that to these artists in England. And of course, many of them didn't even know that we were printing their, these would be like color covers for like Tales of Terror, beautiful painted color covers. And one of them, what really tipped me to one of them looked like it was a cover for Hobby Magazine. And I thought, this is a cover for a hobby magazine. And I said to Diskin, was this published in England as the cover for a hobby magazine? He goes, no, it's never been published. He goes, but you're right, it probably was done as a spec, you know, painted for a hobby magazine. So I actually had to commission someone to write a story about a boy who does painting his little hobby things, and they come to life and everything, and make it a terror story on top of it and a horror story. And while I'm doing all of this, I'm going, I swear this is a cover. Anyway, it turned out it was, and the guy never got paid by Des.
Wow.
And yeah. So it's a long, weird tale what happened with it. And the Shanus brothers were completely without fault. And Mike Friedrich was without fault. It was Des Skin who screwed some. But on some of the things, he was not involved. He was only involved in the English stuff. So yep. The American things that came through Pacific, we simply bought those rights.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we did odd things like one issue of Gru.
Yeah, that's what I remember is getting Gru. But I think, Sergio has always kind of shopped that around to different publishers anyway.
Of course, yes, he's his own character, you know what I mean? Right? That's very important. Creators' rights mean that you can do that.
Yeah.
And as a publisher, you must never become attached because, you know, you make a little money as a publisher. Why do publishers publish? It may be a kind of a feeling of it's collecting taken to a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, look, here's my things I've created through these other people that I've purchased their art. And so being a publisher, you do a lot of things out of passion and love. And that's what we did, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, I should know this, but you can clarify. It'll just be easier to ask you. Okay, so Eclipse and Claypool. Mm-hmm. Were you part owner of both of those, or what's the difference?
Eclipse, I had shares of, and it was founded by Jan and Dean. And after I'd been working there for a while, I said, you know, I think I should get some stock shares in this. And so I ended up with some stock shares. And when Dean and I divorced, he got those shares back. And in exchange, we made a swap and I got that house that we had bought together and so forth.
Okay.
And so that was it was a fair trade. He bankrupted the company later, but that was on him. Okay. I ended up with the house, which I barely was able to, you know, I had to rent out rooms in order to make my mortgage at first until I got my next company started. As soon as I got my next company, Lucky Mojo going, I was able to pay off the house.
I see.
All right. Okay. So anyway, but to go back, the Claypool was Richard Howell and Ed Via. And Ed was a longtime fandom friend of Dean's. Really close friend of Dean's and a friend of mine to a lesser extent. Richard Howell was a really good fandom friend of mine and his late partner, Carol Kalish. And we just really liked each other. We knew each other and liked each other. When Carol died, it was just devastating. And Ed funded Claypool Comics and Richard then found the talent. He got hooked up with Elvira and he got Dan Spiegel. He got all of those people. That was all his doing, right? With Ed's publishing funding. And then they had no distribution. And so Eclipse didn't have a lot of distribution, but our distribution was better than what nothing, right? Yeah. So Dean and Ed worked out a deal in which Eclipse became the distributor for Claypool. And that meant the Eclipse bug was put on them. And then I became involved in doing, you know, typesetting and stuff and so forth. When Eclipse went under, I was very surprised and very pleased when I got a call, would you like to work for Claypool? Because I thought that was the end of my career in comics. But I went on to keep on working for Claypool. And the sales, of course, were lower. It was a more limited black and white line. But I kept on working for them until, as I said, eventually I met my husband, Nagashiba. He worked for them. And eventually they went to a digital only, and they didn't need anybody like me or Nagashiba anymore.
Got it. Yeah. All right. Yeah, because as a fan, you know, when you just see these things, it seems like, you know, the one company became the other company almost.
Yeah, I know. But we always had the Claypool bug, you know, the little logo, the Claypool logo and the Eclipse logo together. And you can see when then they stopped being together and those just continue to be Claypool. We just went on. And I was very grateful that Richard Howell, you know, felt that I was, because I was in a, you know, pretty bad state of mind, you know, losing a marriage and a business at the same time, right? And he said, no. But I never owned a share of Claypool. I was simply a freelance contractor person.
Got it. Then earlier in our conversation, you're mentioning you have an interest in animation. Have you written animation columns too? I seem to remember that, but maybe
I'm not. I've mentioned in passing. I've written about animation that impressed me a lot.
Okay.
But, no, I've never been a formal writer on that particular topic. Okay. Although God knows I could, but it's there are so many people who are so good at it that I love reading their findings and their correlations and things like that.
Okay. Because I was thinking, I guess I'm confusing you with somebody else, you know, because I do remember your work, of course, in Comic Buyer's Guide and Comic Reader and Comics Journal and all the other stuff. So I said, was she in Mindrot or Animania? You know, I was thinking,
I remember once writing a long thing that ran for several episodes of about Flip the Frog.
Oh yeah,
I was like, I had my horror story. You know how my life was almost destroyed by Flip the Frog, and no, really, I'm not kidding. It made me realize that life was not worth living, and was a terribly dangerous place. And why were they showing this to me at such a young age? Anyway, whatever. But yeah, I know. It sounds sort of weird in retrospect. It was a bad experience with Flip the Frog.
Oh.
It probably was shown on television, you know, in a cartoon cavalcade type show. And it was this particular, you can look it up sometime. It's called Don't Play with Matches.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah. Okay. So imagine being 4.5 years old and watching that.
Yeah.
That was Maybe. Almost ruined me.
You'll be happy to know that Steve Stanchfield with his Thunderbean company is putting out a digitally remastered complete Flip the Frog collection on Blu-ray.
Oh my God, I'll have to get it and see if I've grown up enough to be able to stand it.
It was supposed to come out like this spring, but I think it's been pushed back to this summer because he keeps getting, you know, elements and upgrading it. It's supposed to be the most pristine Flip the Frog collection ever. So once it's ready to come out, I'm going to order one. It's just, I'm kind of waiting.
Actually, it actually is something I would like because the horror of it, but that's the only animation I ever wrote extensively about.
Interesting.
and I got a lot of sympathetic letters from readers going, oh yeah, that scared the shit out of me. Yeah.
Well, I mean, some of those things can be jarring. I mean, I remember as a little kid, they and me saying little kid, late 60s, early 70s, they used to show awful colorized versions of Betty Boop and stuff like that.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But I didn't know they were awful colorized. I just knew that it was Betty Boop. Mm-hmm. And that was the freakiest, weirdest shit I'd ever seen in my life. And I was like, what is this? You know, but I'd watch it because they aired it like at Saturday mornings at 6:30 or something.
Yeah. See, now I could stand Out of the Inkwell.
Yeah.
I could take it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I had to kind of, you know, go into my stance and kind of grit myself because I'm going to be watching Under the Equal now and it's going to be kind of freaky. But Flip the Frog, too much.
Now, Flip the Frog, I didn't know about till, you know, probably the late 70s. I used to get the Black Hawk film catalog and they'd talk about it, you know, and so I started learning things there. And then, of course, the key book for any animation fan is Leonard Maltin's Of Mice and Magic. So, and
right, yeah.
And I'm good friends with Jerry Beck and everything. So it's like, you know, it's like that's the book everybody, where it all kind of made sense, you know, of it all. Because before you just say, oh, here's this character and why is this made by this company and why is this one by this company?
I know. It's like, why does it say wood on that log? You know, that's when the light bulb goes on and the kid wakes up and goes, this is created and I can play too. Right?
I have a question and for you. Based on
one
that
other
too.
Thing about animation, I really got in as a kid, I really got into the Warner Brothers celebrity animation. You know what I mean? Where there would be these different Al Jolson.
Yeah, caricatures.
And I became obsessed with trying to identify them. And as a child, with no access, there was no VHS, there was no replay. You had to have either caught that film somewhere in an art house or, you know, on TV late night. And I'm trying to figure out who these people were, calling in my mother, and she didn't know because she was a refugee from Nazi Germany. What does she know? You know, she's looking. It's a woman. You know, it's a woman with sad eyes. I don't know who it is. You know, it was supposed to be Greta Garbo or something.
Yeah.
And so I'm calling all these American friends of my mother's. Who is that? And they'd say, oh, you know, that's so and so. And so I began keeping these lists of who these people were, and then I wanted to find their movies.
Right. All right. Okay? Which now it's easier, but you know.
Of course, back then it was like this. Back then, being a collector or a fan was this, you had to keep your own mental spreadsheet, you know?
Right. I used to do that. But, you know, my Google was my dad, who's still around. And I'd say, who is this? I mean, I'd know the obvious ones like Jack Benny or something, but it would be like, I'm not having any fun. And then it's like, who is that? And, you know, even my dad didn't know who that was, but it's Ned Sparks now that I know.
It's Ned Sparks. Yeah, right. Yeah, the other one, it was always in the, you want to buy a duck? And I'm like, what the fuck is this?
And then the other one I was going to say is the guy goes, whoo-hoo-hoo, with his hands, and it's Hugh Herbert, but nobody,
right, Hugh Herbert.
Nobody, even my dad didn't know that one. He goes, oh, I used to see him in movies. I don't know, you know, it's like.
Yeah, right. But see, that's such an interesting one. You mentioned that one because I ran across a Hugh Herbert movie and I went, oh, wait a minute, that's that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
I had first seen it in one of those cartoons. Yeah. So it was a whole deep dive into the pop culture of the previous generation, which I loved. I really loved it.
Yeah. And it kind of surprises me and I can't say it upsets me. It surprises me when like people will say, who's so and so, you know, and it's like, who's John Wayne, you know, is some young person. It's like, you know, somebody that was for years iconic, you know, regardless if you liked him or not, you know, it's like, he was just iconic, you know, it's like, it's gotten to the point, who's Elvis? Who are the Beatles? Who are, you know, it's like, wow.
Yeah, my mother, bless her heart, used to belong to the Jane Austen Society because she couldn't stand people asking who was Jane Austen. But, you know, it's like a big time and pop culture is like a series of finer and finer meshed screens, right?
Yeah.
And so everything gets dumped in. It's a very coarse mesh. Everything comes through 10 years later and then next 10 years. And by the time you've gone through 500 years of this, only this very little powdery dust comes out and is labeled Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But who else? You don't know. Right.
No, I mean, there could be another Shakespeare, but we don't know who he is because he's forgotten. That's
right. Oh, you could look at artists of the Renaissance or anything like that. It's always about time. And so if you're like at one of these levels of the screen, your personal interest goes back 100 years, let's say.
Yeah.
But 120 years, you don't know. But there are still people alive right now who are scholars who read, you know, Assyrian or whatever. And they're like, we recognize them as like, you know, rare ducks in the British Museum or something who can read Assyrian inscriptions. But imagine them walking around going, why can't everybody read Assyrian? It's so important.
I guess the surprising thing is it doesn't. This is showing our ages, I guess. You know, it doesn't seem that long ago. You know, but you know, it is in a certain respect. You know,
yeah, it is that long ago. You know, like... they say that pop culture has a life cycle of 40 years.
Yeah,
and for 40 years, the price builds and then it falls off because all the people who remember it and would have collected it have died. Yeah.
And then you get fluky things like, I'll use Star Wars as an example. You know, it's like kids now watch Star Wars 1977 version like it's a brand new movie and it's 45 years old. And, you know, when I was a kid, that was new and it had, you know, I don't even know if I even saw any movie that was 45 years old. It would be some silent thing, you know.
Yeah. I know what you're saying. And I tend to collect things in runs, and that's so now you can do it.
Yeah.
And Nagashiva and I are just recently, for the third time for me and the second time for him, going through all of the Zatoichi movies. These are these Japanese martial arts movies about a blind swordsman by this guy, Shintaro Katsu. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I've heard of him. Yeah. Well, and I think I've seen a couple of them because.
Yeah. If you want to imagine a guy who, when young, looked like Elvis, but when old, looked like Hurley of the Three Stooges. So you watch him through these movies. I mean, he just begins to look, he goes from Elvis to Curly. And
but I haven't seen the Curly ones, apparently.
Well, he gets older and older, and he looks more and more like Curly. And he plays this blind swordsman, and they go through their, you know, their opening, like, here's a random movie, and like, oh my God, it's a hit. We've got to make another one just like it, and we got to make a third one. Oh, now we've got to change the plot. And then it just becomes weirder and weirder and weirder, and eventually it's really weird. And I watch these things as runs, you know, or we do like, we'll have something like some character actor like H.B. Warner. Like I went, oh, look, I liked H.B. Warner in this movie. Let's watch every movie that H.B. Warner ever made. Right. So we go through these things. Right.
I've done that before. Yeah. certain actors or certain directors or certain writers, screenwriters. I follow sometimes. You know, and so, you know, I can't think of all the ones, but like, I love the Coen brothers. So I've seen everything they've done.
Right. Sure.
You know, I think I've seen everything Hitchcock has done.
Sure.
You know, and I can't think, you know, actors, probably more comedians that I've seen everything they've ever done. Jerry Lewis or Bob Hope or, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, you know, Roland Hardy, whatever. So.
Exactly. Well, we call them ironically film festivals.
Yeah.
But we pick some really wacky, you know, guy, like we're having a Stuart Irwin film festival, right? And like, who's, but you know who Stuart Irwin is, like 90,000 people don't even know what we just said, right?
Well,
but
you
know, why not have a Stuart Irwin film festival, you know? Or we're going to have a what's her name, Maud Ebern film festival, and she's like this, you know, old lady character, right? But yeah, and it's fun. And IMDb, I contribute pretty heavily to IMDb. Writing reviews and also correcting misinformation, which is like
good
my
luck.
Thing, right? Oh, I know. I'm also a compulsive Wikipedia contributor, which is just horrific. You know
Here's
what I mean?
A plane.
It's just, you know, it's almost like a addiction. It's like confessing. I contribute to Wikipedia. You know, hi, my name is Catherine. I contribute to Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And they say, have you gotten help for that? But I really like doing that, using IMDb to discover these things and then assembling, you know, and then you come up to the one movie that nobody has available. It can't be found at Sinister Cinema or Alpha Video or not. It's just gone. It's not on Amazon. It's nowhere. And then somebody offers a VHS tape of it for $85.
Right.
You're like, do I have to hold up my chronological viewing of every Stu Irwin movie to pay $85 for this one VHS? Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. You know? That's one thing I've never understood, you know, about the reissuing of things since you mentioned that. It's like, you know, things, I get it when things came out on videotape. That was basically the first format. I'm not going to count Super 8 or whatever.
Right.
You know, that you could get a complete feature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they probably generally thought, well, we better put out the hits first and then go to the more obscure things. What's odd to me is when you carry it over to DVD and then Blu-ray and then 4K and whatever's next, you know, it's what makes the cut to go to that next level? See, you know, and it's not always the big hit movies.
Yeah, you know? Now you're talking about what I was talking about. Yeah. In mining engineering, this is called a classifier. The sieves with the different degrees of fineness of mesh. It's just called a classifier. They go through the classifier and a new technology or a new layer is added before everything gets through the frickin' classifier, right? Yeah. And yeah, I have stuff still on a DVD that I cannot find streaming.
Yeah.
I have stuff on VHS that I cannot find on DVD. You know, and you're kind of like, oh no, you know, but I want to watch it every 20 years or every 10 years, right? And the same is true for music. Oh my God. I mean, you know, it's just horrifying when you look at some country western or blues musician and they've got, you know, like the 18 greatest songs this guy did. And then what about the other 20? Right? Yeah. They're not available.
Right.
And they are available on 78 RPM records. But you know,
if you
can find them, right? And you'd think that with this, with digital publication now, I'm an archivist, and I take and transcribe old newspaper articles about hoodoo, which is African American folk magic, and I have a whole website called southernspirits.org, as opposed to southernspirits.com, which is a liquor store. It really is. But southernspirits.org, I transcribe these, and this is what my patrons pay me for. Every week you get some new historical thing because nobody else ever bothered to transcribe it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and I do it for very small bucks. I mean, you know, Patreon doesn't pay for much, but just pay for me to do it. But the idea that it's all of our, if you love something, think about how you can distribute it. You know, it's important.
Yeah. Well, we're getting near the end again, so I will this time I'll wrap it up. But I usually ask one last question: is you know, if you're making any personal appearances, or if you have any new projects? It sounds like you're always working on something, or how people can contact you.
Okay, my husband and I together own about 85 domains. So if you're interested in what we're interested in, you'll find one of those domains. But the biggest domain, which also lists the others, is called luckymojo.com. And at Lucky Mojo, you'll find a forum, which is forum.luckymojo.com, where you can pretty much post, "Hi, Cat," and I'll answer you. There's tens of thousands of people participate in it. I'm working right now on a book called Astrology for Root Workers, which is about the history of astrology in African-American culture, something which many white people believe did not exist. And I've just become fed up with them and wanted to shove them to the wall and put my hands around their throat and say, "Fuck you guys." And so it's a whole book about a historical astrology by Southern Black root doctors. Mm-hmm. And, I'm also editing and publishing other books. We do a festival every year called the Virtual Hoodoo Heritage Festival. It's on Zoom. So I'm doing that. I'm not making personal appearances. I'm pretty autistic and never like social things anyway. Mm-hmm. And as I've gotten older and COVID made an excuse, I just became crankier and stayed home more. I do have a model railroad in my yard, which Nagashiba and I run together. And the National Garden Railway Association National Convention will be held in Santa Clara this 4th of July weekend, and our layout will be open to the public. So if you like G-scale steam locomotives of the 10-wheeler era, come and see our layout. There's always something happening in Ironwood land, you know, it's what it, pick a part of popular culture and you'll find me working in it, publishing in it, producing in it, enjoying it, buying it. That's what I do. You can find me on Patreon, Catherine Ironwood, and subscribe. And if you subscribe at the high rate, you'll get a box full of all my cast-offs that I'm upgrading.
Very cool. All right. Well, I want to thank you, Kat Ironwood, for being my special guest on today's Fun Ideas podcast.
It's a great title, Fun Idea.
Thank you so much
for having me. This has been a lot of fun. I'm sorry if I talk too long and too fast.
Oh, this is great. And we will see you next time. All right.
All right. All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Thank you for listening, and thank you, Kat Ironwood, for being my special guest. Remember, you can always watch the video version of this episode on YouTube. Episode number 216 will be coming soon. If you would like to comment and or be a guest on this podcast, please drop me a line at funideas.mark@gmail.com. Become a patron of Mark Arnold and Fun Ideas Productions. If everyone listening just contributed $1 a month, that would be a tremendous help in continuing the production of my books and this podcast. Also, subscribe to my YouTube channel. The opening and closing music for the Fun Ideas podcast is provided courtesy of Andrew the Slow Poisoner Goldfarb and is used with permission. This has been the Fun Ideas podcast. This is Mark Arnold speaking. This episode is copyright 2022. Fun Ideas Productions. Thank you and good night.